Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. Hey everyone, and welcome to The Stacks. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today on the show, we're talking about Tinderbox, the untold story of the upstairs lounge fire and the rise of gay liberation by Robert Fiesler. We've brought back author and former book publicist Joseph Papa to help us break down this book. There aren't really going to be spoilers today, though. If you haven't read the book and you're not familiar with the upstairs lounge fire, there's going to be a lot of new information. If you want more of Tinderbox without any spoiling at all, you can listen to our episode from May 20th, where we interview author Robert Fiesler about Tinderbox. As a reminder, everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the link in the show notes. That link will take you to all the books, movies, articles, and whatever else gets discussed on the show. Also in the show notes are links to all of our social media accounts, including our Instagram page at The Stacks Pod. You can stay connected with The Stacks through any of those links. If you want more of the show, head over to patreon.com/thestacks to be part of The Stacks Pack. That's our own online community that gets you inside access to the show. You can join our virtual book club, find out guests in advance, and get all of the inside scoop. Head over to patreon.com/thestacks and check it out. Audible is an online database of hundreds of thousands of audiobooks waiting to be listened to. And thanks to the folks over at Audible, you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download just for listening to The Stacks. Go to audibletrial.com/thestacks to redeem. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts and that you leave us a rating and review. It goes a long way to helping the show reach new audiences. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Joseph Papa for The Stacks Book Club. We're dissecting Tinderbox by Robert W. Fiesler. Okay, everybody, we are back today with Joseph Papa. Joseph, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Yay.
Happy to be here.
I'm very excited to be talking to you today about this book. It is June and it is Gay Pride Month. And we're going to talk about a kind of hidden story in gay culture, I guess, or the history of America and more specifically the history of gay folks in America. So the book is called Tinderbox. It's the untold story of the upstairs lounge fire and the rise of gay liberation. And it's by Robert W. Fiesler. And it's kind of a mix of true crime meets political organizing.
Right.
It's kind of like both things in one, which we can talk about and later. But before we do, I just want to start where we kind of always start is, what did you think of this book generally?
I really loved it. I did not know about the fire, so mm-hmm. And the events that happened in 1973 or whenever it was, and I think it's beautifully researched, and it doesn't he does a really good job of capturing the space too. I mean, it's New Orleans, which has its own mm-hmm. language, even its own vibe, its own parlance, and he captures that really well. Mm-hmm. And I thought the research, the way that the research is laid out combined with the sort of heart-wrenching story is pretty impressive.
Okay. I agree and disagree. So I liked the book. I didn't love it. I didn't die for it. What I liked was the fire stuff. I liked hearing from the victims. I liked the political context, like leading up to it and during. But I sometimes struggled with the writing. I sometimes felt like I had to keep going back to reread because there was like a lot of commas and like extra language for me that kind of got in my way, which is so rare in this kind of book. I feel like sometimes that happens to me when I'm reading fiction or when I'm reading something that's like more focused on the writing versus the story. Mm-hmm. But I kind of got caught up. Like I would read a whole page and be like, wait, what? Let me go back or whatever. So I enjoyed the content of the book immensely, but the actual writing sometimes got in my way.
I think that's fair. I mean, I can see that certainly. And I think he also struggled a little bit with whether or not to present it in a linear fashion because mm-hmm. it's sort of – I mean, he, you know, like most – you know, like a lot of nonfiction, he starts off with the event. Like
right.
You know what happens.
Right.
You know that
right.
there's the fire. You know the date, the blah, 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 the sort of bare bones facts of it. It's a rough analogy to have used given the topic.
Right.
And then he kind of goes linear, but he sort of jumps. And I can see that certainly was.
Kind of got him. Yeah. The other thing is like Well, I should say this now. There are not spoilers on today's episode, but if you're not familiar with any of this story, it will be new information. The book pretty much starts out laying everything out for you. So there's not spoilers, but if you want to read the book and you don't want to know anything, then I would say stop listening and come back when you finish. But otherwise, it's a pretty safe episode for anyone. There were other things that made it complicated. Like there's a lot of street names, which is always hard if you're not familiar with a place. Because it was a gay bar, there's a lot of men's names, which I sometimes struggle with. I like when there's a variety of character gender so that I can remember like, oh, this name goes with this storyline. That's not his fault, obviously, but all of that stuff kind of contributed for my struggle in reading the book. That being said, I didn't know this story either. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, that was the sort of, that was really what hit at home is I'm gay. I'm very politically active. I worked for an LGBT advocacy group for a number of years. I've been involved. I'm not a wallflower when it comes to LGBT issues. And this was, until the Pulse nightclub shooting, the largest mass death of gay people in the country.
Right.
And I think what's so astonishing, and what he does, one of the things he does really well, is give a glimpse at the really poor job that the media did at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, this, 32 people died in a gay bar in New Orleans, and it barely made the news anywhere, including in New Orleans. I mean, it was, right. I think it was only on the front page for maybe 2 days there,
yeah, two or three days.
And then kind of kept slipping back. But
right. I mean, I definitely want to talk about the response to the event at the time and also now. But one of the things he does say is that the book or the story has received more coverage since the Pulse nightclub shooting than it did in the 40 years between when it happened and the Pulse nightclub shooting, which is like pretty insane to think about 40 years having less coverage than something, you know, and 1973 isn't that long ago.
Right.
Like that right. is very much the people who would have been at that bar are in their late 50s, 60s, 70s now.
Right.
Like for us, that's like our parents' age.
Right.
And so to think that like one of the things that really hit home for me in this book is how much has changed and how much is the same, not always for LGBTQ, but just for how we treat the quote unquote other or the marginalized person.
That was one of the things that was hard for me. Hard is the wrong word, but it was difficult to sort of come out on the other end, because you're right, we've come so far mm-hmm. on for LGB issues.
Right.
You know, it's
that's right. The T.
The obviously we have a lot further work to do for transgender people, but it almost feels like you said this was 73. It's surreal that this is essentially in our lifetimes. I mean, neither of us were alive, but. And to look at how far we have come, I feel a certain I think you and I have talked about this before, but I feel a certain amount of guilt, because I think that the only reason that the LGB issues have come so far is because white men mm-hmm. can fall into that.
Right.
A white man is never going to be a black person, being shot unarmed this is the only other that a white man can be, really,
right,
for the most part. And I think that there are cultural dominance led to the fast acceleration, and it pisses me off, frankly.
Right. Well, it's tricky because you're looking at, like, when we talk about issues of, race, and we talk about women's gender equality or women identifying or, anything to do with gender and gender queerness, that's not inclusive of white men necessarily as the people. And because, as you're saying, because white men can fall into the gay, queer, whatever you want to call it, they are able to get a lot done because they still have the clout of being white men, and they can, in order to make change, they can tamp down maybe part of their gayness in order to like come into a room and say, we need to fight for these things. And the other white men in the room are like, yeah, that's right, this white guy's making it okay. And then he's like, oh, actually, surprise, I've been gay all along and you didn't know. And not because he's closeted, but because he's using his otherness as a tactic. Like, he's using his ability to be in the same room. Right. Whereas if I walk in a room to talk about women's issues, you see a woman, you see a Black woman. I can't not be that
right.
in certain settings. And so I can't use my brain or my other things that I could use if I were a white guy. Like, I don't have that cloak of invisibility. Obviously, on the flip side of that, and this book talks about it a lot, there's a ton of problems with, you know, men having been closeted and like what that brings up. So I'm not necessarily talking about people being closeted. I'm talking about using your other identities in order to invoke change for an identity of yours that is marginalized.
Right.
Is that the right word for it? I don't even know if marginalized is right.
No, I mean, it's a tricky thing to talk about. And I think one of the things is that the book sort of accidentally does is show the importance and need for intersectionality.
Right.
And it's astonishing to me. I mean, I'm just sort of surprised because I feel like now as a gay person that, you know, we have the movement, the LGBT movement is supported by women. It is mm-hmm. supported by Black people, other people of color. I mean, that did not exist in this book.
Right.
He talks about, there were, I think the only victims were white and Black. I don't think there were any other races, but you know, the NAACP had nothing to say. The other racial justice groups had no interest in this
right.
because of the hot button gay issue.
Part.
And, you know, that's something that would, you can't even fathom that happening now.
Well, so, okay, let's talk about, let me ask you this one question, then I want to talk about this a little more. Here's my question. I never know if I'm doing this right or wrong. Is queer a word that straight people can use? Because I use it a lot. Obviously, genderqueer I know is okay to say, but like if I call someone queer, because I know it used to be derogatory. And is it is it an appropriate word for straight people to use when referring to like groups of people whose sexuality can be on a spectrum?
Yes, I think absolutely. Okay. And I think that it's also, there's a small movement or a small push for queer or Q mm-hmm. to replace the ever growing LGBTQ
plus,
you know, and which I don't know if I'm behind. I mean,
they just want Q.
Q. Uh-huh. And to sort of be that catch all and Q being a stand-in for queer. So yes, queer is absolutely usable.
Because in this book, queer is used as a derogatory term. So I was like, oh, have I been using a word that I'm not supposed to be using?
No, and I think it's, and I might be wrong, but I think it's only used derogatorily in the context of the 70s.
Well, right. That's why I'm asking. Like,
no.
Obviously in a book about the 1850s, the N-word would be used versus like a book now written by someone who is using it colloquially or whatever. But I was like, wait, am I using a word that is for gay people or LGBTQIA people that I'm not supposed to be using?
I think it's a safe word. Okay. I mean,
Joseph's giving me permission, but if it's not appropriate, please let me know.
There's a third year Harvard law student on Twitter who will disagree with me.
Okay.
But,
got it.
Yeah. No, I think it's, cause I think it's also just, I think that the generation that's coming up now, I mean, when I talk to 21 year olds, 18 year olds, they don't identify as anything. And not in the same way that I, when I was coming up, like claimed to be bi because I wasn't ready to be gay
right.
yet or wasn't ready to say I was gay yet. I think kids today just like they're not confined by
right.
And so queer is a yeah.
I kind of like the idea of queer it. Also because I feel like it aligns all people who fall into that together as opposed to being like LGBTQ. Well, I'm T but I'm not L. Or I'm I, but I'm not B. You know, it's like
right.
Q is like we're together. And I feel like that also leverages this like white male privilege that comes with this movement.
Right. Well, because we talk about gay rights right. as this thing. And like, I don't think there's anything wrong with the term gay rights on its face value. But it,
when you get
down to it, it isn't. And like, and there's always, you know, in conversations, people will say, you know, I'll say, oh, she's gay. And, you know, someone will correct me and I don't. Like the lesbians that I know don't mind being called gay, but I know it's just this like
right.
really strange area. So all that to say is I think right. queer is this beautiful term that just kind of okay. captures
it. I like using queer. I kind of feel like I felt that intuitively, like this is more inclusive. Because I've done some reading on people who are genderqueer, and it felt like that felt better than saying trans, because not everybody who is genderqueer is trans. And like sometimes when you start getting into these labels, then you have to be like non-gender conforming or whatever. So that was like a whole lot, but I think it's worth saying because language does matter and language is important. And I think on one hand, you can be kind of flip with language and say something for effect or just in a certain setting versus like when you're actually trying to use language effectively, right? Like, you know, and that's true for everyday life, not just when we're talking about race or politics or gender or anything like that. But I do think it's worth kind of noting.
Well, and people, you know, people died in the fire that today we would call trans or genderqueer or, but they, I don't even know what they called them at that time. I mean, it wasn't just nice. Right. Correct. Well, I mean, even amongst the community, I'm not sure what,
Sure. And like, this is also super cultural, like in different countries, there are different gender identities and sexualities that we don't recognize. Like, I believe in Taiwan, they have something called tomboy, which is not what we would call a tomboy. Like, it's not a girl who identifies as a girl who dresses boyish, who likes soccer or something, right? It's like more in line what we would call a woman or a woman identifying who dresses and – or woman who – not well, not woman identifying. A woman who dresses and feels and behaves like a man but isn't actually trans. So like we might say like someone who's butch or something. Like we don't have the right word for it. But there's so much language around gender and sexuality and identity and all of this stuff that it's just like – who knows what the correct answer is.
And it must be so powerful. I didn't know about that. And that's got to just be so powerful to have the term alone, because it gives it a realness that, you know, we don't give to, you know, I mean, I can't – working in politics and working in a queer space and in Virginia where I work, like, so many people will say, oh, what's the Q for? And it's this like kind of, you know – I think some people are genuinely curious, but a lot of even well-meaning cisgender straight people are kind of – they're just baffled by this, and so they mock it a little bit.
Well, and they don't have to take it seriously because it's not their identity. And I think that's part of it too, is like as someone who is cisgender, heterosexual, it's like I need to be taking, or we need to be taking, other people's identity as seriously as we would want someone to take our own.
Right.
And that not knowing is one thing, and you should ask someone that you're not imposing on. Like, I would ask Joseph because you're my friend of a long time and I know that you know me, but don't assume that everyone knows you and expect that they should have to answer your questions for you. Like, there's also this great website. It's called Google. You can find so much there. You can Google, what does the Q and LGBTQIA plus stand for? How about the plus? Like, there are things that you could be doing, but also if you don't feel like that's right for you, like, find a friend. If you have, like, there are outlets where you're not imposing on it and mocking and belittling people, even if you think your intentions are pure, because intentions are a nightmare.
And I love what you that you mentioned, the like find a friend thing, because you and I have both done that on issues. I've done it on issues of race with for you, and you've done it on LGBT plus issues with for me. And you know, it's helpful, and it's great to have a space where you can learn and have a little sounding board on.
So
get yourself a friend.
Get yourself a friend.
Google.
Or Google a friend. Hey, Google, can you be my friend? We were going to talk about something about the book, and I forgot. I said we'd come back to it, and now I can't remember.
Oh, I think it was about the media.
Okay. So the media, basically what happened is this fire happens, and...
Well, should we set the stage? I mean, it was the bar itself was, I mean, in New Orleans, you know, I think in most cities at the time, you know, it wasn't an official gay bar. You had to like ring a bell to get in.
Right. And they had like a green book for gay people, like a vacation guide.
Right.
It was called Bob Dameron's Address Book.
Right.
And it was basically like green book. So it was like, gay folks had this book so they knew which bars were safe for them to go and be out in, or hotels they could stay in and not be bothered by jerks, straight people.
And, you know, so it was also, and this is what I find so fascinating about it, it was also the home of the New Orleans MCC, Metropolitan Community Church, who had lost their space and had started having their Sunday church services right. at this bar. And then Sunday was their biggest night. So people would go to church and then they'd stay and have, you know, $1 unlimited beer for a couple hours.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things the book did for me too was I've always liked gay bars, but I think as time has gone by, I've kind of, I don't know. I just don't, I'm not drawn. I've lost my draw mm-hmm, to them. Mm-hmm. And this book sort of reignited that for me.
Right.
Oh, God, that's my second bad pun.
It's okay. It's not a pun. You don't
Not that. Pun, but my right. second bad figure of speech. It reignited it for
yeah.
me. But really made me realize like the importance of that space even now. I mean, even though I feel safe 90% of the time
right.
out there, but anyway, so they, you know, it was this safe space for queer people mm. and in a place where you could, I mean, at one point just before this happened, the recommended sentence for being caught doing a homosexual sex act was mm-hmm. life in prison with hard right. labor. This is 40 some years ago or 40 some years ago, or I guess that was 50 years ago. Anyway, so it was this place that people could go in New Orleans to find a community. And it was the busiest night of the week, which was a Sunday. It was the middle of summer. The sun hadn't even set, which I just, something about that also just feels weird mm-hmm. that it was still light out when the fire started. It was right near sunset. And,
this is what I wanted to talk about, which is we were talking about the NAACP not coming out and getting involved. But what I want to talk about is the fire itself was set, we think, they never charged anybody. There was never a trial. There was never anything. There's a prime suspect who soon thereafter killed himself. And so there's kind of questions, but not really, I think it's fair to say.
Correct. Yeah.
He set the fire, we think, because he was mad. He got kicked out of the bar for being a jerk, basically. But part of the thing about this book, which I felt like kind of aligned itself with the Pulse nightclub shooting, is that this fire was not set to kill gay people as a terror act. It was set to kill, or was set to allegedly scare the shit out of this bar of particular gay people. Like, so that it wasn't necessarily a hate crime. So, because mm-hmm. the guy who set the fire was also gay. Yeah.
And was a patron. I mean,
he was a patron yeah. and had been there before and continued to frequent gay bars after
right.
this. So like, there is some, you know, in the Pulse nightclub shooting, that shooter went in as an attack on gay, queer life and people, and to make a political point. And this was not political.
Right.
It was scary and it was terror, but it wouldn't be considered a terrorist act, I don't think, because there wasn't a political motive, which is part of that definition.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the weird pieces of the book, because
right.
In so many of these instances, and you know, and burning of black churches, and
right.
Mass shootings that we seem to have every day, there's a deep seated hatred
and a premeditation that right. is not a revenge for something that happened 5 minutes ago.
Right.
Like this
right.
was like he got kicked out of the bar, went to Walgreens, bought lighter fluid, came back, lit it up.
Right.
This isn't, I wrote a manifesto.
Right.
I've been thinking about this bar specifically.
Right.
Like it. So to me, what going back to the NAACP thing and kind of like how nobody spoke out, I don't know that they would have, had it been a straight bar or like a bar, I guess was what we would call that, and someone had done the same thing. Do you know what I'm saying?
I disagree a little.
I feel like, sure, now they would, because that's a marginalized group and there would be some solidarity.
Sure.
But at the time, I don't necessarily know that a lot of groups would be doing that. Like, I think it's both things. Sure, as groups that represent marginalized people, they should be joining together and like sticking up for each other, etc. But like, I don't know that this exact crime is that same thing.
Sure, but no one knew that at the time, except for
true.
The investigators. And
that's true.
And that hadn't really come out until, you know, until years later when they could look at the...
Right. But it wasn't being presented as a hate crime either. It was being presented as just like fire, gay fire.
Yes. And I think, I mean, yes, it was just being That's fair. I would also just sort of, I think another piece of that though is, you know, and this may be getting a little too, you know, philosophical or whatever, but I mean, without the prejudice and without the marginalization, you wouldn't have had the need for it, mm-hmm. you know, in a sense.
Right, of course.
And he also talks about this, I think, in the book, that the, you know, the building wasn't inspected. And right. and in a way, because of what it was,
right.
I think people just kind of like let it, you know, that it right. was just kind of forgotten about
yes.
in a city that had pretty stringent regulations at the time. I mean, he talks about the other buildings on the street that had, you know, I mean, that the it was a wood, it was a matchbox.
Right.
I mean,
right.
it was, it's not a surprise that it burned. I mean, I think the fire itself lasted, I mean, I think 32 people died in a matter of like 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's like 360 seconds, I think is what he says.
Right.
I agree with all of that. Like I'm not saying, I guess what I'm saying is kind of like there's a weird vagueness in the book that wants the reader to connect Pulse and what happened here in a way that I don't feel is fully honest to the spirit of either tragedy. And they're both tragedies in their own rights for different reasons. Like where the upstairs lounge fire to me felt like a tragedy of society overlooking or criminalizing or, you know, condemning people, gay people as a whole, versus Pulse felt like a attack, a hate crime, something specifically against. So like something that was targeting gay people versus something that is a tragedy because these people were gay, they were not given the same treatment that a group of straight people would have. Does that make sense?
Sort of, but I think it's also being—
Or am I being crazy?
Oh, no, neither. I mean, it makes sense and you're not being crazy.
Okay.
Not neither. I think, but I also think there's a benefit of looking of like hindsight
sure.
on that a little bit that wasn't there at the time. And I think if it had been 32, let's take people out of the equation.
Okay.
If it had been 32 dogs
uh-huh.
In an animal shelter,
right.
I feel like it probably would have gotten more coverage
sure.
than it did.
Right.
And I think that, you know, so no, it was not committed as a hate crime, even though I don't think hate crime is, I know you weren't saying this,
right.
but hate crime wasn't part of the language
term,
there.
Right.
But I think that it's still, 32 people died and it was just kind of, well.
Right.
And the way that the media talked about it, Robert in the book says something like a lot of times they would reference that the bar was, quote, very popular on a Sunday.
Right.
To sort of
imply that people right. who would be at church wouldn't be there and gay people
right.
wouldn't be at church because they're sinners.
Right. Or they'd be home with their families
right.
or what have you. And, you know, so I mean, there was this coded language that was used mm-hmm. around it to sort of excuse it in mm-hmm. a way that I think, you know, and then at the very least, then why wasn't there a call for stricter building regulations?
Right.
At the very least.
Right, I agree. If, yeah. Like, I think that the tragedy of this crime or like the indictment of this crime is on society as a whole, as mm-hmm. opposed to the guy who actually lit the fire. Whereas when you look at like the Pulse nightclub shooting, that really felt like he was the bad guy, the
right.
guy who did that. And so that this is more saying like in 1973, America and New Orleans was garbage when it came to,
right.
to gay people
right.
as a whole.
Well, and I think another sort of like sub thesis of the book is that for movements, you know, for whatever the movement is, unfortunately, someone or people have to die.
Right. He says that in the introduction. He says something like, I have it. He says something like the combination of tragedy and politics leads to change.
Right. And
but
this didn't. And I think that's what's so fascinating
right.
because Stonewall was
a few years before,
69, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, that obviously is referenced as this, you know, huge moment of change. And it's just, it's strange that, you know, this, that this wasn't that. And,
right.
and for me personally, Pulse was a huge moment. I mean, my husband and I had been talking about leaving New York, and when the Pulse nightclub shooting happened, it was like a sort of switch went off, and it's mm-hmm. what we had been talking about moving to Virginia. And I looked, you know, the next that week after, I looked up a job. I was looking at jobs, and this job at an LGBT advocacy organization was open. And, you know, I left a kind of nice publishing job to do this. And, you know, I'm, that's an obviously just very personal effect of, you know, a tragedy sparking change. And I think the Pulse, the other thing that Pulse did, I mean, I think it, and it breaks my heart for, well, literally everyone who's died of gun violence, but in particular the students in Newtown, because I kind of thought that was going to be it. Mm-hmm. I thought Newtown was going to be the thing that
brought the about correct some tragedy change. To bring change.
And, you know, it wasn't. And, oh, wait, I'm conflating. I'm conflating. This is how sad America is. I'm conflating two Florida mass shootings. I'm conflating the
Parkland.
Right.
Well, but I was going to say kind of a similar thing is like, you know, per the book, tragedy plus politics equals change. And that is true when change happens. But I do think that like we've kind of stalled out as far as gun violence, tragedy plus politics. Like America is really just blowing it.
Yeah.
And that's a bad pun too. When it comes to gun violence, like what, there is not enough tragedy to make change if you divide by politics, right?
Right.
Like there's nothing, there appears to be nothing in politics that is able to change gun laws.
No.
And right. That's really terrifying. And I think like when we look back in 40 years, hopefully things will have changed and it'll be kind of the same thing as like this Tinderbox story. Will someone will write a book about that terrible church shooting in Charleston and people will be like, oh, I don't even remember that. You know, like that barely made a blip. I mean, people do remember that shooting now, mm-hmm. but still there was the Texas shooting at the church in Texas.
Right.
There have been just so many that like there's going to be a plethora right. of, unfortunately, of books that come out in 40 years where people are going to say, oh my God, I can't believe this terrible thing happened and nobody did anything.
Right.
And yeah. I think that like that, getting back to kind of where we started, which is there's a lot of this book that shows change and progress when it comes to gay rights, but there's also a lot of this book that is still an indictment on America's ability to change and grow and accept people's humanity. Another thing that this book made me think a lot about is they talk about how the men in the gay bars and gayness in general was criminalized and how, you know, just by being in that bar, because being gay was a crime, it made you a criminal and not worthy of a good investigation or fire safety and
right.
inspections. And it made me think a lot about what's going on currently in this country when it comes to immigration. You know, the president recently came out and said these people are animals, which is like the number one way to dehumanize people. And it's kind of that same thing. It's like if you can criminalize people who are coming to this country, then you can say they don't deserve the same things. They don't deserve a bed. They can sleep under a bridge. They don't deserve like
right.
– and that is all this same playbook from when – being gay was a crime, right?
Right?
Like, it's like you're criminalizing people for trying to just like live their life.
Right. And you're, and you make it hard for them to be, you make it impossible for them to be good citizens. You,
right.
You can't, you know, you can't go to the cops for a reasonable, you know, if you witness something,
right.
You can't, you know, you can't, and this applies to both situations, both, you know, what happens in Tinderbox and also what is happening to immigrants right now. You know, you're not in a position to, just live your life in a functional way. And, you know, you, in Tinderbox, you know, you'd be, if you were beat up. And I think this is probably something, you know, we see it with these women, these young women in detention centers who get mm-hmm. raped. I mean, but if in Tinderbox, if you were assaulted by, there was a, you know, he talks about fraternities at the time who would mm-hmm. go into the bars and would lure, it's kind of a la Matthew Shepard,
right?
Who would lure guys out and beat them up and steal their money. You have no recourse because what are you going to do? Say I was right. flirting with these guys and then they robbed right. me because you're the criminal there.
Right.
And we're still doing that to people.
Like I mean, we're criminalizing humanity.
Right.
Like our people's lives.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't want to conflate too many things. However, sure. I do feel like there are parallels. And I think it's worth noting that while there is progress in any one place, there's also still the same stuff going on. It's not like a to-do list where you have all these groups and you're like, okay, check, check, check. Like we turn the page, we're done. It's like you check one box and then that just makes room for a new group of people to be criminalized or marginalized or turned into others. And I think that to see, you know, homosexuality as it was in 1973 and to see so many parallels is really, that was what was hard for me in reading this book. Like, that is what affected me most.
Completely.
Was like, sure, gay liberation movement is awesome. Like, we did it. Gay people can get married. Like, they can adopt children. They can have jobs. They can be out. Like, yes, we're awesome. And then it's like, sure, but and still there's so much more. Right. And like when we talk about these coalitions and intersectionality, like there's got to be more coming from, you know, the LGBT community at this point. And like when we talk about white men and there's so much violence against trans women, mostly, well, trans women period and trans women of color. And it's like, where are these people?
Right.
Where?
No, it's, I think you're exactly right. I mean, and
not to point fingers.
No, but, I mean, I'm a gay white man and I'm pointing fingers at gay white men. I mean, obviously not all, but you know, I think, and I see this time and time again, I think, you know, men make more money.
Right.
So when you have two men, two gay white, you know, white people make more money and men make more money. So when you have, have two gay men, two gay white men together, it's very easy to watch them sort of forget that. You know, I if I could make every gay person, and I do mean gay person, read this book, or a book, it would be this one, because I think it speaks to, it's so, you know, because this was in our lifetime, it's easier to imagine how your, you know, naked ass at Coachella or Burning Man or wherever, and or at Fire Island, like, great, go to those places. I'm not judging the places, but you have these freedoms. Like, you are able to live so openly and not even think about it in some instances, most instances. And that would not have been the case 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that's exactly what so many other people are experiencing right now. And it's, and I don't think a number of members of the gay community have been great about acknowledging that. And I don't think, you know, I don't think it was the author's, he doesn't explicitly say that, but it's kind of clear.
It's pretty clear.
Through.
It feels clear.
And I think that's a triumph of the book in a way, you know, cause he doesn't need to finger wag.
Right. But and the subtitle isn't like the upstairs lounge fire and how it pertains to today. Like it's not. He is telling a very specific story and he does pretty much stay in his lane or like in the lane of the book, which I like because I also like when authors lead me to water, but I feel like it's my own drinking of it. Yes. But I'm like, oh, I figured this out. And the author's like, yeah, you idiot. Like, but there is one part of the book that I just thought was so amazing to read, his writing about the actual fire. Like, it's like 10 pages or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more. I don't know. I could not. I was like wrapped.
You're sweating.
So,
I mean,
it was that writing, that part of the book was so good. I almost like, it's like pages, it's like in the 90s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, what are we going to do now? Because that was like, I mean,
yeah.
And he's telling you how many seconds it's been and like what time it is. And he kind of like starts the chapter talking about where everybody is, including the guy who starts the fire and then the people in the bar, like where they're physically located. And then it starts. And then he talks about like this vacuum and just, it's like so vivid.
It's masterful. I mean, it's a puzzle that he strings together in a way I can't imagine how difficult that was. And it's also, it's a footnoted, not footnoted. It's a, whatever they are when the notes are in the back of the book. But it's, you know, so you can see, I mean, where each piece of information came from.
Right.
And a lot of the people, I mean, a number of people survived. The bartender, got many people out through a back exit that, you know, they wouldn't have known about. And,
because there was no exit sign because nobody came to check.
Correct. And, you know, I was up a flight of stairs and everyone had been drinking all day. So when he does go through it, it's harrowing. And it's harrowing because you're sort of seeing it through the eyes of the people who were in the room that survived. Mm. And that's just, I mean, I don't think I've ever read such a, the people that made it out alive, and some of them did later die, but with injuries, I mean, it's harrowing to read.
Yeah, like the language she uses, like for their skin.
Because it's exactly, it's really graphic. It's direct.
It's very graphic, and I know people get uncomfortable with that.
Sure,
but I think read it anyways.
Correct, because it's but it's also to your point.
It's only like 6 pages or 10 pages.
Right. I mean that piece of it isn't.
Yeah, but it is gruesome, and it's but he does. It's really well done. It's not exploitative, but it is also not sugar-coated,
right?
Which I often hate, where it's like, and then they died, and you're like, wait a second, right. It wasn't just and then they died. Like, this terrible thing happened to human bodies, and like that is something that should be talked about. And
I don't think I'll ever get the image, and there's no. I had to Google. I learned from you about Google.
Oh, thank you.
I had to Google this image because I don't believe it's in the book, but he talks about it. And
the pastor
in
the window. Yes.
So the pastor of the church that met there, the New Orleans MCC, who, you know, by all accounts just sounded like a really
lovely human.
He was trying to escape through the bar with the windows and the barred windows of the bar, and his body just hung out the window for hours. And it's in countless photos that news reporters, you know, and photographers took. And it speaks to what I think, you know, to your point about, like, we're seeing that today, just not mm-hmm. necessarily for gay people, but we're seeing, you know, I mean, how long was Michael Brown. Thank you. I mean, his body lay there for how long? And the, you know, it's
and the little girl whose mom was taken. There was like a little girl at the border, and she became like the face of that, like Rice's drive. Remember?
Yes. I thought you were talking about
not in this.
Yeah, I was
No. It was during, for immigration.
Yeah.
But like these people become these images of injustice, and he definitely was, even though at the time it wasn't that. At the time it was like, look.
Right. We don't care. We don't care enough about this to move this man to a
private
place.
Like a sheet or something. You know, obviously it's a crime scene and et cetera, et cetera.
And I don't want to put thoughts in the minds of the officers, but it also is, it feels like it's not, it's almost like a warning. Like, you know, I mean, like, don't live this lifestyle. Don't be yourself. Don't drink. You know, obviously, I don't think New Orleans cared if you drank, but I don't know. It's just it's a compounded tragedy on an unthinkable evening.
Well, and the police, not so much the fire, but the police people were incompetent at best,
right?
And they were hateful,
right?
I would say also, and there was an institutional disregard and disrespect of these men and women who were killed, or people, I guess was another way of saying that, who were killed. And, you know, from not interviewing suspects, not following up, not doing the work, not keeping evidence, not like, there's just so much. And that is also a page from history, especially when we talk about like the civil rights movement and like the lynching of Black people. Like, that is what I like to call the jig, as in the jig is up. That is the jig. That is the move. It's like, if we don't take this seriously and enter this as something that's important, then it just gets lost and we are the gatekeepers of that.
Right.
And it's like, you wonder why people have a distrust of police. It's not because police are bad people necessarily. It's because the history of the office of being a police officer is being a gatekeeper to whose victimization is matters or not.
Right. You know, and because it is such a theme, an accidental or not accidental, but a sub theme of the book, this intersectionality piece, he writes about a case at the time where I think it was some fraternity guys killed a gay man in a, you know, robbery gone wrong, sort of like what we were talking about earlier. And the defense used this case that because he was effeminate, that his skull was softer, and the jury believed it. And so it's, you know, I think, and that's what we see today with, you know, the Brock Turners of the world, the, you know, these men, like, you just can get away with stuff and against a marginalized community. It's just so much. And
well, and like Harvey Milk, the whole Twinkie defense for Dan White, which is like crazy. Which actually brings me to something that I do want to talk about, which is the gay liberation movement part of this book, which I felt was the weakest part of the book. Like, I was the least interested in that part because I didn't always feel like it was connected as much as I wanted it to be, which might have just been the history.
I think that, but I think that's the point, sort of. And it also was sort of had that really sad hiccup where like somebody came in and tried to like run
the new MCC or like was the new leader and was a scammer.
And he stole money.
Right. I don't know. I feel like there's so much work that has been done as part of like the gay liberation movement that that stuff felt like it wasn't really part of that movement. It felt, you know, peripheral in a way that I was kind of just like, I just didn't feel like that part of the thesis of the book came together as fluidly. Like, I don't know if he drew, the lines weren't clear enough for me what the point was.
I hear what you're saying. I thought the point was that this tragedy happened and nothing happened.
Right.
And what in any other movement would have been this, because again, I don't, you know, at the time, because no one was charged, because there was no, you know, no one knew the cause. This would have been a rallying cry for gay people, and it wasn't.
Right.
And that's, and I think that's like the you know, the movement itself sort of needs to look at that too. I mean, I think it's twofold. I mean, one, you know, if you lived in Richmond, Virginia, you might not have ever known about it because
at the time,
right? I mean, it was on like one nightly news, like CBS, I think, mentioned it.
They said it made it like international and everything for like one day,
right?
Yeah.
So if you're, you know, late getting home from work,
there's no,
you know,
TV.
It's not, there's no, and there's no Twitter, there's no, you know, so it would have been very easy to have just not known that this happened. And I think, I mean, I hear your point because like it's a funny, I think part of it's a funny like bit of the subtitle. Part of the subtitle is The Rise of Gay Liberation. It almost needs like a parenthetical or lack thereof, because
yes, correct.
It did not inspire what it should have inspired.
Right. And like it wasn't a rallying cry like Stonewall or Harvey Milk, or, you know, later he talks about Anita Bryant who was part of making sure that gay people were seen as less than human for just a little bit longer.
Right.
And the work done around Anita Bryant, I mean, that's another book that I would love to read. The book about fighting the Anita Bryant bite, which is part of a lot of, yes, please pay me royalties, which is part of a lot of the gay liberation movement. I think that was like a huge turning point from what little reading I have done. Like, I know in Cleve Jones's autobiography, he talks about it a ton, and it is part of the Harvey Milk movie. Like, it's part of – it was a turning point, essentially. And I feel like there was kind of – in this book, it felt like he wanted –
Completely. Yeah. I hear you. Cause you know, what you were saying earlier about like when the author like takes you to the water, but you choose to drink, he could have like given you the glass on this one.
Yeah. I need to get a little closer.
I think that's a fair,
I was like near I was in, you know, near the ocean, but I wasn't fully there.
Sure.
But I think one of the most important things that I have learned through this book a little bit and just through other reading when it comes to this kind of, when it comes to like the gay liberation movement, is that the thing that ended up being the most probably challenging and the most influential was when people started coming out.
Right.
Because their families and their friends were voting against their brothers and sisters, even if their families weren't everybody was probably a little homophobic because it was socialized in you, but like you had mothers and fathers who loved their sons more than they cared that they were gay and didn't even know their kids were gay, and that the coming out was like so important to that. You also had people whose kids came out and they, you know, never spoke to them again.
Right.
Or never talked to them again. But I can't remember the exact line. It's not in this book. I think it was something that Harvey Milk used to say, but it was like, they're voting against you because they don't know that they're voting against you. They don't know who you are.
I know the line. It's not that, but it's
something
like
that.
Yeah, that's what it – yes. And I think – I mean, one of the things that is so – I think one of the other tragedies of the death toll is that three of the people who died were never identified.
Right.
And I think it's because of that. I mean, I think that they probably had families nearby who just didn't want to admit So right. they never went to the cops and said, oh, Johnny's
right.
missing.
Right.
Or.
Yeah. Yeah. The point is that, of course, in the end, the hardest thing is like the most effective, right? The hardest thing, it's like you're forcing the victimized to do the work.
Right.
But, you know, and that's what ends up being effective, right. which is terrible and also kind of inspiring in a way. It's like you control your own destiny, which is a little bit naive, but that there is some of that
yeah.
in this, which brings a little bit of like a hopeful tinge to a garbage situation and also makes you feel miserable, which is life.
Wait, so you mean that like...
I mean that it's hopeful in the sense that like that there is some blueprint that involves you being able to change your own destiny. Mm-hmm. And then it's also miserable because it's like, why should I have to do the work? Why can't you just see humans as humans?
Sure. I mean, and I think some of that speaks to the white privilege because most of the people were white. I mean, there were a few black victims. But
I think just one.
Just one.
Just one who died.
Okay.
There right. might have been others in the bar.
Yeah, so one black person and one woman. That sounds about like most gay yeah. gay rights. I'm
yeah.
just kidding. Sadly, I'm not. But you know, I mean, I think that sort of speaks to the privilege of a lot of the even though they were completely marginalized, like you said, like when you walk into a room, I see you're a woman. I see that you're black. These were men who served in the military, who had jobs at oil companies, mm-hmm. who you know had. Upstanding, whatever that means, jobs,
right.
and to have come out after this and to have fought for any meaningful change would have been they would have lost their jobs. Likely, they might have lost families. Some of them were married to women, and it's a privilege. And I don't know if it's a privilege in the way that we talk about like white privilege or other privileges today, but it is a privilege to not have to do that. And this right. is a singular case of that
right.
of you know. That doesn't by this I mean being gay is like you said you don't walk into the room
right and, you have the ability to be closeted in any moment
right.
when you are still out in the world like you can be both things at once
right.
and you can use your identity in varied ways which a lot of other marginalized identities cannot
right
yeah I mean I think also like worth noting because we are getting to the end but worth noting. Is that a lot of these men who survived were so traumatized, including like having to go to work the next day and hearing people make jokes about burn.
Oh, he says, you know, what are they going to do with the body? How are they going to bury the bodies in fruit jars?
Right.
Or like burning faggot jokes was a big,
right,
you know, that.
Big, yeah.
And one of the guys had left the bar 30 minutes before and he had to drive back to Houston that night. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the other thing, thinking about that, like thinking about you have got to drive to another state to find a community and...
Right, because he was working on a military base in Texas
right.
and so he was going to New Orleans to see his friends and he was closeted in his military life but was out, you know, he was at
miles
this
away.
Bar basically
right.
and he's... like hearing it on the radio.
Right. Ooh. And then the next day in the military at work, they're, you know, making, you know, burning faggot jokes.
Right.
And it's, I can't imagine the trauma.
Right.
That.
There. Yeah. I mean, I think it is a particularly gruesome crime and fallout. And because of the social moment made even worse, like because of the acceptability of these kinds of jokes and things. Do you have any books that you might recommend to people or movies or whatever about that might be like a good companion piece to this book? Because I feel like this book, at least for me, made me want to read more stuff about this moment in queer history and activism.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned the Cleve Jones
mm-hmm.
book,
I think, really
When
We Rise.
Yeah, which had a mini series. It's wonderful.
I listened to it. It's great. He narrates it.
Yeah. Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah. It's really good.
Another one came out, I think, last year by Timothy Stewart Winter. It's called Queer Clout.
Okay.
And it's sort of like an activism a book that looks at the activism in the queer community. So it sort of picks up on the gay liberation, you know, that piece that you felt was missing from here. This is sort of largely that he covers that. And then coming forward in the book, Sarah McBride's book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, is about, it's sort of a book about the trans experience.
Right.
It's hopeful. it's realistic, and really beautifully written. And she talks about, she's the, she's at HRC. I can't remember her title, but mm-hmm. it looks at the trans experience in a really good way. It doesn't deal, you know, it's not,
it's like fast forward to where we are now.
Exactly.
What's the struggle now? Interesting. I also, the other thing that doesn't, which is like crazy to me that barely comes up in this book is this happened in 1973 and flash forward like 7 years and all of a sudden AIDS.
Right.
And I just think about these men who survived this and then what happened to them. Like, I want to know what their lives were like for the last 40 years and how long they lived and what they did and what they're like now. Like, I just feel like there's like this whole other thing that's just like waiting in the wings for them that like the reader knows about.
Right. Isn't it so weird to read about, right, when you read about anything gay pre 81, 82, and I mean, it's almost like a hurricane before radar. I mean, it's just this, and particularly for, when you think about what, like you said, like what the people that survived this and then had to watch people, you know, more people die.
Right.
It's, it's heartbreaking. It's terrifying. I sometimes can't wrap my mind around.
Yeah. Have you read, The Band Played On by Randy
Shaw? I have not.
I've not read it either. I have it. It's so big and intimidating, but it's one of the things that I really want to get to because I think though some of it is a little bit fabricated, when it comes to Patient Zero, that whole thing.
Right.
But I think some of it is pretty, it's supposed to make you pretty pissed.
I'm also excited about, and this is predating this, but it just came out, When Brooklyn Was Queer, which is a look at sort of like queer Brooklyn and queer New York and a time when, you know, there was a real community. I mean, that thrived in a way that I think you only can in a city like New York, even in the, you know, early 1900s.
Right. Well, I feel like Cleve Jones's book, which is like right before AIDS, basically, he does a great job of talking about like what it was like before and like the freedom and the, you know, the fabulousness and all of that like is just, that hurricane analogy is great. It's just like wiped out. Okay. So the last two things we have to talk about are just the title and the cover.
Oh yeah.
What did you think? We kind of talked about the title, like the subtitle a little bit. Do they bring up anything for you?
It's funny. I hadn't thought about it, and I forgot that was a question because I know that you asked that. You're right about the subtitle. I think we're in agreement there. That could have been a little. It could have changed.
But I do think it's right on for what the book is, except for he just needs like the evolution, or like the involvement of or something,
right? Tinderbox to me, I don't know. Like doesn't ring. It sort of falls neutral, and I feel like there might be a more powerful title. I don't know what it is.
I liked it.
Okay.
When I saw it, I was like, oh, this is about a fire. Like, I knew, I didn't, obviously, the subtitle helps, but I didn't know what fire, but I, like, the cover and the title, to me, like, work well together. I also love that it's blue and yellow and not like orange and red and like really in your face. And I like that it's a picture from the time. I always like when the cover is like contemporaneous to the story.
I do like the photo a lot.
I love the photo. Yeah. I actually think it's a really good looking book.
Yes, I agree. It's a good package.
Yeah.
Insider term.
Oh, I didn't know that. Good package. Okay. Well, do we have anything else we want to say? I didn't do movie. Did you have any casting? If this would make a great movie.
So I can't believe we didn't talk about this, but somebody wrote a musical. It's a few years ago. Max Vernon, is a composer in New York, wrote a musical called The View Upstairs.
Oh.
And I haven't seen it. I've heard some of the music, but it's
about this.
Yeah. It is about
the
fire and about, I think a lot of it is sort of, I think you get the bar, like a lot of action happens at the bar,
which
I'm interested in. I mean, you'd have to have that for the movie or for.
Right. If you made it a movie though, you could make it more of like the hunt for the guy, like that, like you could have kind of like the three storylines really easily, really easy. Cause it's like, there's the hunt for the guy, there's the gay liberation, and there's in the bar and the victims and like what happened that day.
I'd kind of want more of the latter. I mean, I really want to know.
Yeah. More about what happened and the people in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have casting though. I mean, I know because I think you're exactly right when you said that there, and this is no one's fault, but there are like five Roberts And I mean, right. there's just a lot of...
There's a lot of just like white guys.
And I mean, I think also anything about a southern city just allows for some, you know, interesting characters. I mean,
right, that's true too.
You know,
I would love to see if they made this movie to actually cast out gay actors, because there are so many.
Are there?
I mean, yeah. And I feel like it's like, you know, you're going to get Harvey, like the Milk movie with like Sean Penn. It's like, couldn't you find someone? I mean, and he did great in it, whatever, right. blah, blah, blah. But like, why not cast
right.
some gay dudes in this movie?
I think that would be the only sort of downside for me about the movie, is that it would be so many men.
Yeah.
And just because, I mean, there was one right. woman who died. There were a few other women there. And, you know, women just don't play a huge part in the right. story. I mean, there's a supportive mom. There's one of the guys was married to a woman, and she yeah. was fully supportive of his.
And then there's the woman that the guy who set the fire married, who changed her name to his name, even though he wouldn't have sex with her. I died. I forgot about that part.
That was pretty crazy.
That was wild. Anyways, yeah, there's yeah. not a lot of woman parts. Yeah. This movie would lack a ton of diversity. However, I do feel like it's a super interesting story that Completely. Hasn't been told, that I would push my need for diversity and everything to the side if it was told by that group.
And,
like, I don't need the well green done. Book of this story. I don't Absolutely need it to be produced not. By Brad Pitt.
Or
like,
the Queen movie.
Yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody yeah. by Bryan Singer. But no, he's gay. No thanks, Bryan Singer. Anyways.
We don't count him.
Well, he's not even... He's.
Do you guys want him?
No. Black people or women? Nobody wants him.
I meant you straight people.
He's fired. Do we have anything else we want to throw in or add about this before we go?
Just, can you believe we got through a whole podcast and didn't talk about Charles Manson?
Now we have. Also, suggested good reading. Manson
by Jeff
Gwynn, and obviously Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi. How dare
Bugliosi.
You?
Vincent I'm Bugliosi. I'm so sorry. May he rest in peace.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Joseph.
Thank you for having me and talking about a gay book.
Yay. And we'll see you guys in the stacks. Okay, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Joseph Papa for being our guest. If you want more on Tinderbox, check out our interview with Robert Fiesler from May 20th. Everything we talked about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, or check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the fun. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. Go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in the stacks.